We've said that you can start a fight in America using just three letters, GMO. Genetically modified organisms are among the major issues of our time, and our guest this hour explores many facets of GMOs in a book that also makes use of the word fight. The book is called Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. It's a very thorough examination of the many issues within the GMO debate. McKay Jenkins is the author. He's a longtime journalist and now journalism professor. He was once a staff writer for the Atlanta Constitution. He has written several books, including a previous work about trying to avoid toxic substances in our daily lives. McKay is now a professor of English, journalism, and environmental humanities at the University of Delaware. McKay Jenkins, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure. You're certainly not the first person to write about GMOs, and I wonder if you took this up somewhat reluctantly.
Well, I took it up reluctantly mainly because most of my colleagues in the journalism world warned me against getting anywhere near those toxic three letters that you just mentioned.
Right.
But I figured that was, if anything, an opportunity to try to look inside all the noise that you hear, actually noise coming from all sides of this debate. There's a lot of heat and not always so much light, and sometimes that in itself is a challenge for a journalist to kind of get underneath all the hubbub. So that's what I set out to do, and as you mentioned in the introduction, I really did travel quite a bit, talk to not only scientists but farmers and advocates and political figures from the eastern shore of Maryland all the way to Hawaii, with Kansas and St. Louis and New England all in between, trying to figure out what's going on with this debate. What are people saying? What can we believe? What can we trust? Are these things as dangerous as some people say? Are they as benign as some people say? Are they as necessary to feed the world as some corporations say, or are they something else? And the book really turned out to be fairly complicated, really. There's not any real black and white answers here, and I thought that was the most interesting part of it all.
Yes, I would have to agree there that it's, nobody clearly running around with white and black hats on, so we're going to have to think a little harder than that to get through this. There's an illuminating story that kicks off the book, and it's about something called the Flavor Saver Tomato. What was so cool about that?
Well, the Flavor Saver Tomato was introduced to the public as the first genetically modified food product in, I think, 1994. And even now, 20-plus years later, it stands as a very symbolic event, because genetic engineering, even then, even in the early 90s, was a brand-new technology that was about to, we thought, or people thought at the time, unleash this flood of new products, unknown, unexplored, untested products. And the tomato was going to be this kind of, kind of the front end of this trend. And if the thinking was, if people got into this tomato and really liked it, that would remove any worries they had about genetic engineering as such, as a technology. There was quite a bit of very interesting political back and forth about whether this thing should be regulated, and if so, by whom and how, under what standards. Should genetic engineering be considered some kind of external input into the food system, or is it just simply another outgrowth of, you know, ages-old hybridization? And this debate, honestly, in some circles, continues today. Now, it turned out that the tomato didn't taste very good. It was designed to ship. It was essentially designed to be a tomato within the larger industrial food system. So it was nobody was going to go to a farmer's market and buy a local Flavor Saver tomato. The Flavor Saver tomato was designed to be shipped across the country, so a grower in California could have a tomato arrive unbroken and unbruised in, you know, Connecticut. It turns out that worked. I mean, it was a thick-skinned tomato that stood up to shipping, but it didn't taste well, and people didn't buy it, and that thing kind of flopped. Now, that story has resonance today because there continue to be new products being introduced to try to put a positive spin on the entire world of genetic engineering. Just, I think, 2 weeks ago, a week ago, you saw news about this thing called the Arctic Apple, which is a brand new GMO product that has been released by a company in Canada. And I think the same thing is going on. This is not a giant industry. This is not a showstopper of a product. But the bet by industry is that if people accept a GMO apple, with all the kind of, you know, red-blooded American emotions that apples bring up, maybe they will say, oh, look, see, GMOs aren't that bad. They've got an apple out there. If there's an apple, how bad can it be? But as I hope we will talk about, really the GMO debate in this country has nothing to do with tomatoes or apples. It has to do with hundreds of millions of acres of corn and soybeans, which really is where the vast majority of genetic engineering is being focused right now.
And you talk about that, driving across the country with your family, which you describe as something of a dichromatic landscape.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I'm 54 years old, and I've driven across the country probably at least once a decade, every decade since I was in college, and I see different things, as you always do with each trip. And the most recent trip, we drove from Baltimore, where I live, all the way to Vancouver Island. And when you drive across the United States, basically from Maryland, I would say, well, Pennsylvania anyway, from Pennsylvania west, you hit basically nothing but industrial farms from Pennsylvania all the way to the Colorado Rockies. And by that, I mean you essentially see corn, soybeans, and wheat. Now, in the United States, there's in the neighborhood of 300 million acres of those crops. Now, it turns out that wheat is not yet genetically engineered. This is something that surprises a lot of people because they know that GMOs are used for industrial crops, and wheat is one of the primary industrial crops. But right now, there's no commercially available GMO wheat. But something in the middle 90% of all corn and soybeans grown in the United States is all genetically modified. So what that means is when you're driving across the United States and you see 300 million acres of these three crops, many things can come to your mind. Number one, what kinds of foods are these things being used to make? Number two, what else could this landscape be used for? You know, this has been deforested. It has been denuded of all kinds of genetic diversity, and all in the name of making these industrial crops.
All right, much more to talk about with McKay Jenkins. His book is Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. You got a pretty good overview just now. We have much more to talk about with McKay, and we'll take your phone calls and emails as well when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the journalist and journalism professor now, McKay Jenkins, who is writing about GMOs in his book Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. It's a very comprehensive look at a lot of different people doing a lot of different things involving genetically modified foods. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. By phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So these miles upon miles of fields of corn and soybeans and wheat to a lesser degree across the country. And so what is the figure? About 90% of the corn and soybeans are genetically modified by now?
That's correct. And this is really where the conversation about GMOs should begin, not with these one-off, calendar posters of, tomatoes or apples or some of the global products, which we can talk about later, but really in the United States we should be focusing on genetically modified industrial scale crops, so that we're really talking about corn and soybeans. And what's interesting about this, and this was one of the most, to me, the most interesting parts of the research, was if you think about the 300 million acres of monoculture crops in the Midwest, that's where all Americans' grain production is happening, where their food production is happening. And one of the reasons that certainly on the East Coast, that this is true is because after World War II, we bulldozed all our farms and turned them all into subdivisions. So when you drive up and down the East Coast from Boston to Atlanta, you not only have the interstate highway system, but you have all the ring roads around all the cities and then have miles and miles and miles of suburbs. In Maryland, where I live, in just the last 40 years, we've lost something like a million acres of farms and forests, all in the name of subdivisions. So if you think about that and you scale that up, if you think about all the local farms, we've lost something like 4 million small farms in the United States since the 1930s. 4 million small farms have been shut down and replaced with housing, largely, or the malls that supply the houses with all their consumer products. That means that all the food production had to go somewhere else. So we used to have local farms providing local food for local people, and that has not been true now in about 60 years. So what that has done is created an entirely new way of eating, which is an industrial way of eating with a few crops providing the building blocks for all the processed food, all the fast food, all the junk food that we eat in such enormous quantities. So part of the reason for all this industrial GMO cropping is that it is used to, for example, feed the something on the order of 9 billion animals that we consume every year. This is where I live, there are something like 570 million chickens on the eastern shore of Maryland. You know, out in the west, there are, you know, these CAFO cattle farms that are feeding, you know, grazing cows. These cows were raised to eat grass. They are now fed industrial corn because it fattens them up really quick. The chickens are fed GMO soybeans. So the GMOs really in this country are used at as the foundation of an industrial food system that is providing us with high-calorie, low-nutrition food. So that's the domestic conversation. There's a very different GMO conversation that we can have about the way that the global food system can depend and maybe even benefit from genetic engineering. But on this continent, really what we're talking about is using GMOs to create a whole lot of very low nutrition, high calorie food.
Well, when you think about the fact that the corn is used to fatten up the cattle fast, I mean, why wouldn't a similar product do the same thing to humans?
Well, this is absolutely right. And this is why, you know, a national obesity epidemic is not the fault of GMOs. It's the fault of a diet that is entirely indebted to high-calorie food, fast food, sodas, and all that kind of stuff. But GMOs are an integral part of growing all that food. So you can't really say it's not a GMO problem. It's really all tied up with industrial food production.
McKay Jenkins, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. So when you take agriculture to an industrial scale like that, it begins to make a little more sense that when you're running an industry, you want to make sure that your product gets to market with as few blemishes and interruptions as possible. So you look for ways to make it resistant to herbicides, things like that, you know, or resistant to pests.
Yeah, I mean, you're bringing up some really important questions. I mean, not only that, but you also want, or put it this way, we as a country, as a culture, have become used to, not to say addicted to, our food being absolutely uniform. So, in other words, I'm sure you've probably done shows on this, the amount of food that is wasted in this country is something on the order of 40% of all food that is produced is thrown away uneaten. And part of that is that if you see a tomato that has a blemish on it, you don't even put it out on the shelf because nobody will buy it. Or a potato that has some funky little thing grown out of its ear, you would never put that out because Americans want perfectly spherical, perfectly, you know, uniform products. That is an unusual way, historically speaking, to eat, to have some notion of perfection. So industrially producing food that is monochrome, uniform, the same whether you buy it in Vermont or Nebraska, this is a very odd way to eat. It has eliminated local food culture. It has put a premium on industrial production. And, you know, GMOs in that world make perfect sense because that's the kind of food that GMOs and industrial food is very good at producing. It's not very good at producing quirky, eccentric, local food that is only, you know, crab bisque in Maryland and lobster bisque in Maine and, you know, gumbo in New Orleans. That stuff can't be made by a GMO machine. That has to be done by local chefs using local ingredients.
When you step aside from the industrial character of the American food system, though, I mean, you get into some other areas, which is the idea that because there are now 7 billion people plus on the planet and they do need to eat, that we're trying to do things that can improve health. And so it is reflected in the book as well that there was some altruism and still is in genetic engineering to try to create things that will feed people well and perhaps buffer them against some of life's problems and diseases.
This is a very important point. And for those of your listeners that think that this book is some kind of diatribe against GMOs, I want to disabuse them of that. This book is really tries to take a pretty round look at all this. And certainly, I interviewed a whole lot of very brilliant scientists, agricultural researchers doing just the kind of work you described, trying to create nutritious food or drought-resistant food or insect-resistant food for developing countries. That the thing is that the people who are doing that research are largely university professors or nonprofit agricultural researchers. This is not industry getting involved in this. And the question about feeding millions or billions of people is an argument that the industry will put out saying that, you know, we need Monsanto to feed the world. That is a disingenuous argument because the world does not need more of what industrial food is producing. It doesn't need more soda and it doesn't need more fast food. What it needs is more support for local farmers to be feeding their own people, just the way it really ought to be in this country. We need people to eat the way they've always eaten, which is with local expertise, local ingredients, high nutrition, high attention paid to soil health and water health and all that sort of thing. And those things are pretty well disregarded by most industrial food production.
Chapter one in the book is called, Are GMOs Safe? Is that the right question? Let's go to number two. Is it?
Yeah. Well, you know, the fact is that most of the world's, and I mean the world's biggest and most reputable scientific organizations, have declared with great uniformity that that genetically engineered foods are no more risky than regular foods. And that's what they say, and that's pretty much the common consensus. There's greater consensus on that, for example, than on whether or not human beings cause climate change. I mean, that your listeners may not like that, but that's what they have said. Now, that also is a very limited question because, you know, you open that aperture up just a tiny bit and add to that these GMOs are often grown specifically to be sprayed with herbicides and pesticides, which there's also quite a bit of consensus that those things are bad for human health. So to pull the thing apart and say, is the engineering part benign but the pesticides bad, you really can't pull them apart because they're always used together. So that question, you know, if that's all you want to know about, is the technology bad for your health, you're going to get an answer, and that's a pretty limited way to think about this. Really, there's much more at stake there. The herbicides, there's also what industrial food production does to, say, water, drinking water, whether it's depleted or whether it's being contaminated, what it does to the health of the soil, what it does to the health of the climate. All these other things have direct impacts on our health that are, you know, a little bit further down the road from the question of just the genetic engineering itself.
McKay Jenkins is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, longtime journalist, now journalism professor at the University of Delaware. He's written a book called Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. He logged a lot of miles on this and got into a lot of different corners of the GMO debate to try to figure out exactly what is what. You do a good job breaking out a lot of different categories here, like showing us the four kinds of genetically modified plants approved for use in America, which are herbicide tolerant, or they make their own pesticides, or they have altered nutritional components, or they have built-in virus resistance. Do they generally have to fit those slots, McKay, to get approved?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, especially given the current administration, this question of what regulation there is of food generally or food technology specifically, it kind of ebbs and flows with different administrations. I mean, generally, the federal government has been very hands-off with this because, after all, the companies, the big companies that are arguing for some of these things are some of the most powerful companies in the world. These are, excuse me, the companies like DuPont, Monsanto, Dow Chemical. These are some of the giant American chemical companies that are also the ones responsible for making all these seeds. So you can imagine the lobbying influence that they would have on federal regulation. And ever since, when you mentioned the Flavor Saver tomato, even before that thing came out, there was a lot of lobbying back in the 80s and early 90s about how the government should basically just back off and let agricultural companies do their thing, and they've done their thing. And we have suddenly woken up. And like I mentioned, we've got hundreds of millions of acres, mid-90% of which are all GMOs. And it's not like Americans ever kind of voted on this. They began eating it and now are so used to it, or it's so invisible that we take it as a given. But all this goes back to regulatory agencies that decided a long time ago that these are what they call the substantial equivalent of regular, normal, historically grown food. Now, all those decisions were made kind of, I mean, not literally invisibly because some food activists were paying attention to it, but the general eating public was not aware of how all this kind of happened. It's sort of suddenly now we have it, and it covers the entire landscape, and it covers our entire diet, and most people have no idea that they're eating GMOs in every bite that they eat.
Let's take some calls here. We have Jenny in Roseburg on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with McKay Jenkins, the author of Food. And let's hit the button on that one. Okay, let's go to John in... one more time. Let's go to Jenny in Roseburg. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for taking the call. So, yes, and thanks for this topic. You touched on it, the safety question. It drives me a little nuts whenever I hear it, mostly for what you said, which is it's the wrong question, not so much is it safe for humans, which we're so hyper-focused on, but is it safe for the environment? But the other thing about that question that bothers me, and I'd like to hear your thought, is to to say are GMOs safe sounds to me like saying are chemicals safe, because every GMO is a different thing. And if anything, us on the side of with concerns about these, we don't make the distinctions. It seems to me like there's a big difference between a strawberry that's been crossed with a mosquito and a salmon that's been crossed with a jellyfish. And the idea that we're, I'm sorry, I know it's not crossed with, I'm being hyperbolic, but...
but anyway, the idea is that it's modified with the genes of another.
Like this idea that GMOs are safe or that we are fighting GMOs as opposed to we are trying to look at each of these things individually and say that in general they need to be addressed in a much more nuanced way by government and industry and regulation. What would you say about to that?
All right, thanks for the question.
I think that's an excellent point. In fact, I think one of the big problems we've had is that we lump all GMOs as such in one big basket, and they really, have nothing, in many cases have nothing in common other than that they've had their genes altered. So whether you're talking about, a public university scientist trying to design a drought-resistant cassava plant that will be of benefit to drought-stricken Africa. That's one kind of GMO. Another kind of GMO is to create herbicide-resistant soybeans that can be spread on 100 million acres in America to create cheap chicken nuggets. That's a different kind of GMO. Another one is to take, a salmon and cross it with another species to make it grow bigger and fatter and faster to get to the table quicker. And then you run the risk of that animal somehow escaping into the food system, into the ecosystem, and monkeying around with the genetics of non-GMO species, whether you're talking about animals or plants, because GMO plants, of course, can cross with non-GMO plants. So once again, this is way beyond human health. It has to do with a very delicate ecological relationship between lots of different kinds of species, and mankind does not have a particularly great record at tinkering with ecosystems, that every time we do something, there are ripples that break out in all kinds of directions that we really have no way of predicting, whether we're talking about DDT, whether we're talking about our carbon footprints. We do one thing and think it's a brilliant move and only wake up 10, 20, 30 years later and realize this is percolated in ways we never could have predicted. So that's the kind of the precautionary principle that most people in Europe, most governments in Europe have really been holding to, that we don't really know not just whether this stuff is safe, but we don't know what it will do once it gets scaled up the way it has in the United States.
So to continue with the idea of organisms introduced into an ecosystem, I mean, there is some work in the book that parallels research indicating what has happened in the bodies of animals who've had GMO foods introduced, in pigs in particular, I think is what you're looking at here.
Right. So there's one of the scholars that I interviewed for this book when I suggested to him, or when I repeated the line that, that you'll hear this from all the big scientific organizations, no studies have ever proven that eating GMOs is any worse than eating normal food. And I said to him, what's your take on that? And he said, well, the fact is that no long-term GMO studies have ever been done on humans. Most of these studies are done on animals. And in fact, with animal studies, there is some indication of different things that happen, like you mentioned with pig digestive systems, with their reproductive systems. But he said, really, that's not the issue. The issue is that this technology, in the scale of the history of science and investigation, is relatively new and has only been done in a pretty limited way. What we were talking about before, its impact on ecological systems and the way that genes move around a system and get in other organisms that were unintended. This is the kind of research that is ongoing and needs to be explored much more fully.
Is anybody actually engaging in research, for example, to find out if perhaps some of the food intolerances that seem to be on the rise in society are any connection to what's going on in laboratories?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there's some interesting studies that say that some of the GI disorders that humans are manifesting in kind of epidemic proportions now, things like celiac disease and gluten intolerance, may not be because of the resistance or intolerance of the protein in the plant, but maybe because of either the GMO part itself or even more likely the chemicals that are sprayed on the GMO plant. So, for example, I mentioned that wheat is not GMO, but wheat is often sprayed with glyphosate, known as Roundup when it's a Monsanto product, right before it's harvested. It uses a desiccant to dry out the wheat before they harvest. So, other words, the wheat that people are consuming, the last thing that was done to it before it was harvested is it was sprayed with this chemical called glyphosate. Now, glyphosate, just in the last year or so, was declared a probable human carcinogen by the World Health Organization. Now, that is not, again, a GMO issue. That's an industrial agricultural issue. But this common consensus, we all assume that it's the protein in wheat that is causing celiac or whatever it is, and it may not be. It may be that there's something else going on, and this is the kind of research that's going on in some quarters right now.
More with McKay Jenkins and Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet, in the next segment of the Jefferson Exchange. As we go to the break, let me remind you that we have a segment on Planned Parenthood coming up on Friday, and we are seeking your stories, your audio stories, on our phone line at 541-552-6331. Yeah, does Planned Parenthood mean access to abortion or STD testing or cancer screening or birth control or something else? We want to know. So leave a message on our voicemail line, 541-552-6331, 6331. We're collecting listeners' experiences with Planned Parenthood. 541-552-6331 for use on the Jefferson Exchange on Friday. Back with McKay Jenkins and Food Fight in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is McKay Jenkins, longtime journalist, once a staff writer for the Atlanta Constitution. He's written several books, including one about avoiding toxic substances in our daily lives. He goes after GMOs, but goes after GMO information, starting from the middle. It's a very long journey, talking to a lot of people with a lot of different opinions about GMOs and a lot of different facts to support those opinions. His book is called Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a call from John in Grants Pass. You've been patient. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the exchange.
Thank you. I have a question about the third world. In the third world, you know, Nigeria, I don't know what, you know, India, and not about Monsanto, but are the people themselves in those countries concerned about GMOs, or are they just basically desperate for something to eat? I mean, I think that's a legitimate question. Is there a level of concern? I mean, I guess that second part of my question would be, does it make Americans look a little on the spoiled side that they're just looking for something to eat generally, and we, the majority of us like me, have plenty to eat, and yet we're a little more
cautious,
selective about what we eat, if that makes any sense.
It does. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that's a great question that would take, 350 pages to answer properly. Let me do my best to answer that. So are Americans spoiled in what they eat? I would say in one way, yes, we're spoiled because we have access to pretty much any food that we want any time of the day, any time of the year. So you can eat a tomato in Oregon in February, and I can eat a watermelon in Baltimore in February, even though they don't even grow you get a tomato somewhere from California right now, but you can't get a watermelon maybe even on the continent this time of year, but we can get one shipped from someplace. So that's the luxury of living in a wealthy country. On the other hand, Americans are nutritionally, undernourished. We do not eat a nutritionally dense diet. We have, as I'm sure you know, a national problem with low nutrition and obesity and diabetes and all the things that go with eating the high-calorie, low-nutrition food that we have. The developing countries, depending on where you are, have very different problems. They have much more severe problems with drought. They have more severe problems with pests. There are all kinds of things going on, and there's a lot of work being done to create crops for those small constituencies, whether you're thinking about cassava plants, as I mentioned, in Africa, or you're thinking about a product that's been worked on for decades in Asia called golden rice, which is a rice grain that has been infused with beta-carotene that then, when you eat it, becomes vitamin A and helps fight off childhood blindness and early death. Now, the problem with some of these things is that you're starting to mix science and politics and culture. So in Asia, there are cultures that everybody in the first world thinks would benefit from having golden rice. But people in Asia, for a variety of reasons, have refused to accept it. They say, for example, rice is white, it's not orange. We don't eat orange rice. Thanks very much. And people say, look, this is good for you. And they say, it doesn't matter if it's good for us. We don't eat it. It is not culturally appropriate for us. Or they say, golden rice is fine, but we eat short grain rice, and this is long grain rice, and we don't want it. And you say, well, it doesn't matter. You should eat it. It's good for you. And if they say, we don't eat that kind of rice. And this is the kind of thing that it's not just about nutrition. It's also about culture and being aware of the ways different kinds of people eat. There also is the argument that a lot of these people in these countries are very suspicious of first world industrial corporations coming in and dropping their products on them. They don't. It's not just that they don't trust GMOs. They also don't trust, Western-style capitalism coming into some of their cultures. So this is also something that is beyond merely nutrition. It's really about, you know, global relationships and what kind of history, what kind of reputations do we have with these different people around the world. None of this is simple. None of this is simple. These are all very good questions, and they're tied up in a very complex global food system.
And it seems like some of the complexity is another kind of genetic engineering, and I'm being metaphoric here, but the idea that you really have some crossbreeding between chemical companies and agriculture and regulators, and it seems like it leads to quite a codependency. And I don't want to, I'm reluctant to use the term co-conspiracy, but the fact is when you're convinced that something is good, you continue to proceed with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a very big part of things, and God knows we hear a lot about this in recent political debates, and some of this I'm actually very sympathetic with, where you have people around the country see what happens in Washington, where you have, I don't know what the technical word is, but let's say collusion between some of the wealthiest industries in the world and the very small cohort of people in Washington, D.C. that are charged with regulating them or deregulating them. And to say the least, virtually every industry that we're talking about, whether it's food, whether it's chemicals, if you want to extend it to pharmaceuticals or fossil fuels, all these industries, they want this fight, all these fights to happen in Washington, because it's much easier for them to control political outcomes when it's only a small body of people in Congress. If this is why you see such resistance to state initiatives like the California effort to put labels on GMOs, mm-hmm. for example, they hate having to fight these battles in state capitals because it diffuses their power. Their power is focused and located in Washington. And, of course, this is where all the primary regulation happens and laws get written. I mean, I have three chapters in this book about Hawaii and these local efforts in Hawaii trying to regulate either the pesticides or the GMOs, and time after time after time, these companies successfully argue that you do not have local control over your own land. This is a federal issue. How do you tell somebody in Kauai, a tiny island on the west side of Hawaii, that they don't get to control their land, that this is a federal issue? And that law, you know, is heavily influenced by these corporations. So this is where some of this distrust of the centralized power of politics and money has real validity, in my opinion.
Well, I never thought about it that way, but I mean, you spend your money a lot more efficiently if you can spend it in one city with a small group of people lobbying them and making campaign contributions to them versus trying to hit all 50 state capitals.
Right, and then you design the law to be focused, you know, emanating out of Washington rather than emanating out of state capitals or local jurisdictions.
Like forbidding those local jurisdictions from doing it. In fact, we broadcast out of the only county in the state of Oregon that was allowed to hold a binding vote on banning GMO crops, which was successful.
Well, it's a miracle that the companies weren't able to convince judges there that this was not a viable legal argument. And in California or in Hawaii, they said, that's all fine. You had a democratically decided referendum or a democratically decided vote on the city council, but you are now trumped by federal law that supersedes that, and they've argued that successfully in federal court.
You know, and it's not just the folks on the political end of things and the corporations. I mean, you point out that there are some famous scientists who really would like people to be left alone to do their work in the laboratories, including James Watson of Watson and Crick fame.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm sympathetic. Like, scientists want people to be off their back, and I understand that. The trouble is when science enters commerce, and suddenly it's not just a theoretical experiment, it's an experiment that is going to be scaled up and in this case literally enter our bodies, you can't divorce it from regulation because a government is supposed to keep an eye on things that have the public health and the environment in their interest. The trouble is when you have science that then percolates up to industry and then percolates out to the rest of us, you've got to have somebody watching the hen house. It's one thing to say scientists should be allowed to operate independently, but not when this thing is penetrating our very daily diets.
Did you get a sense of infighting within science, McKay? I mean, is there some resentment from researchers trying to develop healthier foods through GE, directed at the researchers trying to make food crops more resistant to pesticides, for example?
Well, you know, I my sense of it from the outside is that the primary headache that scientists, plant scientists, for example, feel is they feel under attack. What's interesting about it is, like, in climate science, they are under attack by the petroleum industry. In plant science, they feel under attack by the consumers. You know, it's weird because in plant science, they have industry on their side, but they have consumers as their enemies. So you have somebody doing plant research, and they're getting picketed or getting bullied by people saying, how dare you work on GMOs? All GMOs are bad. And they're like, no, they're not all bad. The technology itself is very benign. I mean, the technology can be used for this or that. Some things could be good, some things are bad. So the scientists, I mean, it's tough being a scientist these days. If you're a climate scientist, you're getting hammered in public by industry. If you're a plant scientist, you're getting hammered by the public. And I'm very sympathetic. They're trying to do their work and let the results kind of percolate out into the culture. But, you know, it's not an easy time to be doing this.
No. There are some interesting anecdotes in here, too, though, which make you realize how we got here. The Roundup Ready seeds were developed a really interesting way, and it sounds like it's simply that they were the ones that lived at the dump site.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what Roundup seeds are supposed to do. They're supposed to survive. They're supposed to survive whatever chemical contact they have with glyphosate, and the ones that they discovered, that was sort of by accident. But nowadays, glyphosate is, I think, the most ubiquitous herbicide in the world, and it's so common that plants now, I think pretty famously, are becoming resistant to glyphosate. So now the glyphosate doesn't work anymore on the weeds. So now they're with glyphosate-resistant weeds. Now they're having to come up with what they call stacked herbicides. So they're taking glyphosate and combining it with another chemical called 2,4-D, which used to be part of the constituency of Agent Orange in Vietnam. So now we have glyphosate and 2,4-D herbicides that are sprayed on these new seeds. And the question is, you know, where GMOs were supposed to reduce our dependence and make less toxic herbicides more of the common thing. Now, when we have resistant weeds to this, now that the chemicals are getting more toxic. So, you know, this is another thing where each generation of technology is designed to replace the problems of the old technology. So where this leads is hard to predict.
It should surprise nobody that you entered this as a journalist and obviously left as a journalist and came out of this realizing there's way more complexity than a lot of people think. I mean, are there any clear ways ahead that seem to present themselves to you? Because it seems like we never get to, like, see, there's the science. That proves it. We never get to that point.
No, and I think that, you know, you mentioned the last book I wrote was called Contamination, and that was all about the synthetic chemicals that show up in our consumer products. And what you just asked reminds me of this whole thing about the cancer question, which is people seem to be waiting for some doctor somewhere to come up with a magic pill that's going to make cancer go away, which is, I hate to say it, like a ludicrous and even kind of a dangerous idea, because it absolves people of having to actually do any thinking about what they actually do with their lives, what kind of products they buy, what they put on their bodies, what they put in their bodies. I mean, if you think that there's somebody who's going to miraculously save you, then that absolves you of having to actually think about this stuff for yourself. So, I mean, in this book on GMOs, I'm really sympathetic with scientists and I'm really sympathetic with farmers because both of them are simply trying to do the best work that they can. And I'm a little bit critical of consumers who seem to be awfully passive about these things. It seems to me that consumers are the last stage of the agricultural system. So you get to vote every time you put something in your mouth. And one solution, at least in North America, and this may be globally true, is to eat with more intelligence. I mean, eat in a way that will sustain not just your body, but your landscape and your local farmers and the soil and the climate and the fresh water. And that generally devolves down to eating locally, if you can, eating food that is grown locally and eating organically, if you can. And that means putting more money in the pockets of farmers that operate locally. Wouldn't it be nice if the farmers in your community were some of the wealthiest people in town? Because then they would be able to, you know, stand up to developers trying to buy their land. You would suddenly have local food culture. You would, you know, try to grab some of that Midwestern migration back to all the far-flung corners of the United States where people used to grow their own food and no longer do. So it's not, I mean, I realize that's slightly utopian because we've got to unwind about 60 or 70 years worth of industrialization and suburbanization and all that sort of thing. But it seems like that's at least a direction to point ourselves in.
And finally, McKay, we got about a minute left. You included your students in the GMO debate process. What did you require of them at the University of Delaware?
Well, you know, it occurred to me when I first heard a farmer friend of mine say that she talked to some kids in a high school and she asked them where potatoes came from, and some kids said they grow on trees. And I thought, well, we need to figure something. I mean, how do you get a college degree and not know where a potato comes from, especially at a land-grant university? So I said, you know, we got to fix that. So I started requiring my students to come out and work on a farm, an organic farm. Believe it or not, this is like old home ec kind of teaching. I mean, this is a university-level course. I'm talking about English majors going out and planting carrots and harvesting potatoes and weeding. And
are you still there, McKay?
Yeah.
Okay.
So doing all that, so like getting their bodies inside the food system themselves so they realize what it means to grow food. That was the plan.
All right. Now, they've learned a lot, and we have certainly learned a lot from the book. It is a very thorough look at a lot of different facets of the fight over genetically modified organisms. It's called Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. McKay Jenkins from the University of Delaware wrote it and joined us today. McKay, thanks so much.
Thanks for the call. I appreciate it.